Faces who are here, but now Vanessa are cool. So it would be better if we introduce ourselves and yes. Just before that, I just wish to welcome you all this morning. And the portfolio committee has got one agenda today. Oh, it's two. I mean, yeah, we've got two items in our agenda for the day. But this morning, we're going to deal with one, which is the deliberations on the rental amendment bill. Then this afternoon we are going to meet with the human rights watch group. They've requested the meeting with the portfolio committee to discuss the issues that are affecting the plight of farm workers, I believe so. So they would like to draw the attention of the portfolio committee on the issues that they have observed through their oversight. I believe that that is welcomed by the committee. And we have requested that the department should be represented so that they can also respond to some of the issues. I believe that Mr. Ngwenya will sit together with two members there in our second meeting so that they can assist. In fact, all the officials from the department, they respond where they are supposed to be responding. With those few words, you are all welcome. Just to brief the department, because I won't say I'm briefing the committee, but I would say to update the meeting. On the issue of the bill that is before the portfolio committee, we will recall that we have started this process in October in 2011, and we hoped that by this period we'll be through. Is it mine? I don't think so. Oh, okay, I understand your situation. No, I understand. You are excused. I wish to put this on record on behalf of the portfolio committee that we have not managed to fulfill our commitment as we thought, because the bill that was presented before the portfolio committee was of a technical nature, and we agreed last week when we were discussing this matter that this bill is of a technical nature. And when we look at the bill, there was an unfortunate situation. I think all of us are aware that the Principal Act is very, very fundamental in any amendment. You cannot do an amendment to an act without the Principal Act. And unfortunately, we did not have the Principal Act at our disposal. In the archives, there was no Principal Act. Government printers, there was no Principal Act. The department did not provide us with the Principal Act, with the copy of the Principal Act. So on the first and second sessions, we didn't have it. Now we managed to get it last week from the government printers. They've had copies. And then that is when the portfolio committee had an opportunity to look at the Principal Act. Although we did not have challenges when we were discussing or in deliberating the amendments that have been brought forward by the department before the portfolio committee, we did not experience any challenges because we were discussing and we happened to come to terms on other issues. So it's not an issue. But the issue now is that this bill, the Principal Act, is amended for the third time. The Act, which was repealing the Apartheid Act, it was repealed in 1999. And then there was an amendment that was done in 2007. And then today, or this year, yes, 2011-12. There's another amendment that is brought before the Portfolio Committee. We are not condemning. I would just wish to put this on record again. The Portfolio Committee is not condemning the actions of the department by taking this the issues that they have brought before the Portfolio Committee. But the Portfolio Committee also has got a responsibility to play, because once we have been looking at the matters that have been considered by the department, we do have a responsibility as people who are doing the oversight on the ground. That is our responsibility. And what is expected, I think as from 1999, we should have, by this time, both arms of the government, of the state, which is the government as well as parliament, we should have done an assessment. Whether we do it individually or we decide to do it collectively. But I believe that by this time, there should have been an impact assessment of how these legislations that have been, these reforms post-1994 have an impact on the ground. Are they changing the lives of the people? What is the rationale? Are they do what is supposed they are, that they are doing? Yes, they are. But what are the milestones? What are the shortcomings? And that process has not been conducted appropriately. I won't say it has not been conducted, because it somehow the department may say, no, we have done it. That is why we are bringing this amendment on the governance structure. But on the side of Parliament, we are on the ground as individual MPs. I want to repeat that. As individual MPs, we are there, Shalanarantu. We see, we hear, we listen. As a portfolio committee, collectively, we are on the ground. We see, we listen, we hear, we observe. We can call it whatever. So when we were looking at this, we found that there is a dire need. There is a dire need to take this opportunity to also look at the Principal Act. Secondly, there were public comments that were submitted to the department through their advert. And unfortunately, I would say unfortunately, those public comments were not responding to the advert of the department. Some of them. They were responding to the challenges that the people are having on the rental sector. Then the department decided to overlook those issues and confined themselves to what they advertised. I'm not sure about the policy of government, but I would like to refer to the responsibilities of Parliament, because I don't know why they've decided not to consider those issues that have been raised, because to me, I believe that it was also their opportunity to use it. Okay, Tina, we have been focusing on this matter, but now people are raising critical issues of which it was their opportunity to look at them kwangoko, and then bayilungise into yabo, but ke abakwazanga. Bona ke thina ke, we are guided by this constitution. We've got a mandate, constitutional mandate. And then our constitutional mandate is also embraced by the rules of parliament. So as the portfolio committee, we've got a right to amend. That is a mandate. You initiate a legislation, you amend a legislation, you approve a legislation, you reject a legislation, you redraft. So what we have done, we have looked at the Principal Act clause by clause last week. We have done our homework thoroughly based on the observations on the ground through our oversight, based on those public comments that have been raised, submitted by the public, based on the complaints. I want to office them. Complaints from the public. Even yesterday, by the time we were busy here, when I opened my phone after the meeting, there was a lady who was raising an issue about the maintenance of her flat, that Sharon is she. Although I have not yet spoken to her. She raised this issue to say she has been raising this issue with the landlord. The landlord is not maintaining, and she's continuing paying the rent. Now she has been consulting Koldisa, and Koldisa Ukateli Ndlebe Dumbile. Now she decided to say, no, Koldisa is not assisting her. So she emailed me. I've got that email. Last week on the 18th, these things, they ziyenzeka coincidentally. And thina siyazijabulela, appreciate. Because when this is happening during this time, we are busy with the legislation. It means there is a problem in the rental sector. Whether we like it, whether we don't like it, the problem is there. Noma siyafuna kuthethwe ngayo, not as standard taken. The problem is there. You can go to your Tony and Same thing the students have been harassed, abused, and there in the public comment, there is an issue that is raised by the students. But government uthini na get students as rentai. Although tina when we are looking at, we have not yet have a solution. But there is a challenge. People have been abused there, two students. Kuna mali yabo nje ufumeneka I deposit yabo lapho kuma 17,000 abangayifumana ngifuna kuba ifumene ehamba ne interest. So you can go there and look at it. I've got a copy with me. If you want it, I can give it to you. So those are the issues Parliament has to respond. This is a Parliament that is responsive to the issues of the public. If vision of Parliament is clear, we've got a good vision. Let's see anyway, in the Parliament. When we are doing umsebenzi wethu sihamba sihambe sizozi-check ukuthi i-vision ye-parliament 18. So I'm trying to say ke kule introduction yam, whatever i-committee eyenzileyo, people must not feel offended. No one is targeted here. The department is not targeted, and no one is saying the department is not doing its job. Bona babonile ukuthi no, they can do this part. But it in a way we have expanded our role. Singenile ku Principal Act, Bongi, singenile mtakwethu. Ayihlakaza. Ofuthi ke sitike kuni nxa ubangaba sinibethe ezikonsini. Bingeyonjongo yokunishaya ikonisi. Senza umsebenzi wethu. Kuzawufuneka ke sikhoparate omnye nomnye. Ukwenzela uba siye phambili. But ke bazasilida ke i-legal unit yepalamente ipresente umsebenzi wethu esesiwenzile as i-portfolio committee. And then we'll see the way forward. But I can assure you, the bill is not rejected. That's the only thing I can confirm now. The bill is not rejected. That's all. I thank you. Oh, my sister is sitting here.
Introducing herself. Good morning, everybody. I'm Gloria Corbin, a member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Butch Stein, a member of the committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jabu Sosik of the committee.
Good morning, Ndwabandu Machova.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Archibald Fiedler, member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Togozani Nokushe. I'm a researcher in the Research and Development Unit attached to the Social Transformation Cluster.
Morning, I'm Samina Anwari from Eyewitness News.
I'm Chanel from Eyewitness News as well.
Edwin Conroy, ANC Research Unit.
Morning, I'm Temba Kupula, Parliamentary Communication Services.
Morning, I'm Nokaya Mnese, a member of the committee.
Morning, I'm Porase Bon, a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Morning, Keke Amadishava, Department of Human Settlements.
And I'm Advocate Lady from Human Settlements.
Milile Khaba, Assistant to the Director General, Department of Human Settlements.
Sean Solomon from the National Department of Human Settlements, Office of the Director General.
No, we took kindly, South Government Data Office.
Susanna Bruce, PMC.
Good morning, my name is Gondi West Lufunda. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Lawyer.
Morning, my name is Nombo from the Office of the Chief State Lawyer.
Morning, honorable members. I'm Kwesi Ngwenya from Legal Services in the Department of Human Settlements.
Morning, my name is Pendile Nduli, Department of Human Settlements.
Morning, my name is Leah Potsoa. I'm the researcher for the Portfolio Committee, Human Settlements.
Good morning, my name is Noli Kwatembani. I'm from the Department of Human Settlements, Randall Housing.
Good morning, my name is Gary Rada. I'm the legal advisor.
Good morning, Shemaine van der Merwe, parliamentary legal advisor.
Morning, my name is Kosta Pasiak, I'm the secretary.
You know, we know each other now. We can address us properly. I would like to give this opportunity to the legal unit to lead us.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Just to indicate the process, we are not going to wait for them to finish the proceeding. I mean the whole document. At least whenever we feel that we need to stop, they are used to that. We are going to interrupt them and then get clarities so that when we get to that issue, we deal with it and then we finish with it. So you are all invited, state law advisors as well as the department, to interact.
Could I just ask, have the department had an opportunity to actually see this document that we're going through now?
But I think, can I get the response from Shamin?
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I did not forward it to the department. Yeah, there are two or three new amendments that the Portfolio Committee hasn't seen, so I didn't forward the document.
I don't think it's an issue, because all of us, even yesterday, we met with the document here, and then we discussed it. So we are going. That's why I'm saying we are going to be steady and give each other an opportunity. We are not going to rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I maybe can just get everyone on the same page, I'm going to work from a document titled the Rental Housing Act. I think it's the easiest way to go through the amendments. You should all also be in possession of a document titled Rental Housing Amendment Bill, which is a redraft of the proposed bill as introduced by the department. But the proposed amendments in that document have been incorporated into the document titled Rental Housing Act. So I'm going to work through that document so that we can see what is currently there, what has been amended before, and it just becomes an easier document to actually proceed with. The first amendment that I can refer to is on page 3, with the inclusion of a definition for arbitrary eviction. The definition, Madam Chair, maybe just ask some direction. Would you like me to read out the proposed amendments or simply speak to each amendment? Thank you. The definition for arbitrary eviction that we are proposing is: arbitrary eviction refers to depriving a tenant of occupation of a dwelling without an order of court made after considering all the relevant circumstances. Now, already you will know that there are two colors in this paragraph or this definition. Red indicates to the amendments already discussed by the committee, and blue indicates amendments that were made yesterday. So those amendments are new, and members of the committee has not seen the blue amendments yet. You will note on page 4 there are amendments in brown. Those are amendments with the bill as introduced. So just so that it's clear, that is the portions, in other words, that are part of the redraft will be the red and the blue portions. The next amendment is simply a changing of housing to human settlements in the definition of head of department. on page 4. Definition of local municipality has been included in the bill as introduced, and a new definition is included for maintenance. The reason for this inclusion is that when we get to section 16, which deals with offences and penalties, we will see that dereliction of the duty to maintain is made an offence, largely because of the exact problems that the chairperson was referring to this morning. However, there was a concern that failure to paint a wall or to fix a tiny hairline crack might also then become an offence. So we thought it was necessary to insert a definition, what this Act means when it refers to maintenance. We've worked through the Act, and wherever it refers to maintenance, we are of the opinion that this definition will fit. The definition proposed is maintenance for purposes of the Rental Housing Act 1999, Act No. 50 of 1999, refers to such repairs and upkeep as may be required to ensure that a dwelling's habitability does not constitute an unfair practice, more specifically, unacceptable living conditions, and maintain has a corresponding meaning. Accordingly, when we look at offences, it will only be that type of maintenance that is necessary in order to enable the tenant to actually live in the house. The next amendment is under Minister. Simply the housing to human settlement, that was already in the bill as introduced. The next amendment prescribed, the words by the MEC, by notice in the Gazette, is deleted, so the prescribed simply means prescribed by regulation. The next is under Rental Housing Information Office, where the word local authority is substituted for local municipality. This is done by a general section in the amendment bill, but I've indicated in the Act, because the amendment bill indicates that wherever it appears in the Act, it must be changed. If I can take you to page 5, you will note under section 2, subsection 2, there are small amendments to C and D, paragraph C and D, but that's simply to provide for the new paragraph E that is included. This adds to the responsibility of government. And from what I could gather from the policy of the government, the policy of the department regarding housing, this would still be aligned. So we add facilitate the provision of rental house. Subsection 2, measures introduced in terms of subsection 1 must provide legal mechanisms to protect the rights of tenants and landlords against illegal actions by the other party by affording speedy means of redress. In actual fact, this Act is doing exactly that. By introducing the, no, not introducing, but the Act created tribunals, which is the means of redress that the government is envisaging. Subsection 5 on page 6 is a new subsection that the committee has considered. This actually comes from the old section 19 of the Act. Section 19 dealt with the previous Act, but if you had regard to the subsections therein, it actually placed some monitoring requirements on the minister, which the committee felt was very necessary to actually retain in the Act, perhaps not in relation to the old Act, because that has already lapsed. So, subsection 5 to be included reads, the minister must, A, monitor and assess the impact of the application of this Act on poor and vulnerable tenants, and B, take such action as he or she deems necessary to alleviate hardships that may be suffered by such tenants. New subsection 6 continues, for purposes of section 5, the minister may define criteria based on age, income, or other formal degree of vulnerability that apply to such tenants or group of tenants, and amend or augment the policy framework on rental housing referred to in section 3 in such a manner as he or she sees fit. This is, in fact, I think, to some extent, although it places an obligation on the department, it is also enabling the department to perform its mandate. The next amendment on page 6 is in section 3 with the addition of subsections 5 and 6. These two sections deal with financing, which was also a concern of the committee. The department with the previous, last week Wednesday, during the meeting of the committee, indicated that the national department does indeed do the training of rental housing officers, etc. And we felt that it would then be good to include this It does place an obligation on national government, but on the other hand, it also provides it for the support when it does do its budget. The sections read, national government must develop and fund programs to train members of the tribunals and officials appointed in terms of Section 14, Sub 2. Section 14, Sub 2 deals with rental housing information officers and the officials either delegated or designated to work in those offices. Subsection 6 deals with the rental housing information officers. The reason for the insertion of this subsection is that the portfolio committee felt that it is absolutely necessary that rental housing information officers be in every municipality. It is a must. It is not a may. So that has been changed. When we get to Section 14, you will note that. The committee felt that the financial implications can be limited by providing, and you will also note that in Section 14, by limiting the description of an office to indicate that it could actually form part of a current office. In other words, it could be one person working in an existing office simply being trained in respect of rental housing. Financial implications could thus be almost non-existent. So subsection 6 reads, provincial government must financially assist local municipalities not yet on level 3 accreditation in establishing rental housing information offices as contemplated in Section 14. The reason for municipalities on level 3 accreditation being left out is simply that the committee felt that with that accreditation, they also have to indicate that they have the necessary capacity and therefore is responsible for housing. The next amendment is the heading of Chapter 3. The committee felt that this act, even though it contains rights and obligations of tenants and landlords, does in fact not clearly enough spell it out. It is in a couple of sections all over the Act, and it doesn't necessarily say right or obligation. So what the committee is proposing is that Sections 4 and 5 actually be slightly amended so that their wording is grouped together in two different the wording 4 and 5 will remain, and two additional sections will be created indicating the rights and obligations. And therefore, the committee felt it would be good if the heading is changed, so that if a tenant takes this act and says, where are my rights, it is quite clear. It is headed in Chapter 3, clearly, rights and obligations of tenants. So the words relations between will be deleted and replaced with rights and obligations. On page 7, this is the first of the amendments that I've referred to, where Section 4 will remain, but the larger portion of its wording will be contained in Sections 4A and 4B. Subsections 2, 3, 4, 5 will thus be removed from Section 4, so that Section 4 simply deal with the advertising and not being able to discriminate in your advertisement. Section 4A is then the insertion. And I will read Section 4A. It is mostly, in fact, all of it is a repeat of Sections 4 and Sections 5, but it is specifically related now to the rights and obligations of tenants. Subsection 1. Tenants shall have the right to receive a written receipt from the landlord for all payments received by the landlord from the tenant. Oh, there's a mistake. It's good that I'm reading it out. From the tenant, which receipt must. The wording the landlord there must just be deleted. Which receipt must A, be dated, B, clearly indicate the address, including the street number and further description if necessary, of a dwelling in respect of which payment is made, C, whether payment has been made for rental, arrears, deposit or otherwise, and D, specify the period for which payment is made, provided that a tribunal may, in exceptional cases and on application by a landlord, exempt the landlord from providing the information contemplated in this paragraph. Subsection 2. Tenants may request the landlord during the period of the lease to provide him or her with written proof in respect of interest accrued on a deposit paid. 3. On the expiration of the lease, tenants have the right to receive payment of the deposit and interest without any deduction or set-off within 7 days of expiration of the lease, provided that where the tenant, A, is liable to the landlord for any amounts under the said lease, including the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling during the lease period and the cost of replacing lost keys, the landlord may deduct such amounts and refund the balance of the deposit and interest to the tenant not later than 14 days of restoration of the dwelling to the landlord, or B, fails to make him or herself available for an inspection as contemplated in Section 6, the landlord may deduct any amounts to recover any damages or loss which occur during the tenancy and refund the balance of the deposit and interest to the tenant not later than 21 days of restoration of the dwelling to the landlord. Over to page 9, subsection 4. Tenants have the right to inspect the relevant receipts which indicate the costs which the landlord incurred as contemplated in section 3 as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. This, of course, refers to the costs incurred after the tenant has vacated the property and the landlord has inspected and can deduct from the deposit. 5. Tenants have a right to, in the presence of the landlord and before the tenant moves into the dwelling, have the dwelling inspected to A, determine the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defects or damage, and B, register any defects or damage as provided for in Section 5, Subsection 7. At the expiration of the lease, Subsection 6, at the expiration of the lease, the tenant must make him or herself available to conduct a joint inspection of the dwelling at a time convenient to the landlord and tenant to take place within a period of 3 days prior to such expiration with a view to ascertaining if there was any damage caused to the dwelling during the tenant's occupation thereof, provided that A. failure by the landlord to inspect the dwelling in the presence of the tenant as contemplated in Section 6 is deemed to be an acknowledgement by the landlord that the dwelling is in a good and proper state of repair and the landlord will have no further claim against the tenant, or B. failure by the tenant to respond to the landlord's request for an inspection as contemplated in Section 6 will result in the landlord conducting an inspection without the tenant present, after which the landlord may deduct any damages or loss which occurred during the tenancy in terms of Section 3D. Subsection 7. A tenant has the right during the lease period to privacy, and should the landlord wish to exercise his or her right of inspection, it must be done in a reasonable manner after reasonable notice to the tenant. Subsection 8. Tenant's rights as against the landlord include his or her right not to have A, his or her home, person or home searched, his or her property searched, his or her possessions seized, except in terms of a law of general application and having first obtained a ruling by a tribunal or an order of court, or D, the privacy of his or her communications infringed. Subsection 9. The rights set out in subsection 8 apply equally to members of the tenant's household and to visitors of the tenant. On page 10, subsection 10. Tenants are liable for rental and other costs agreed on in the lease upon a due date, but for costs other than those agreed to in the lease, tenants are only liable upon proof of factual expenditure by the landlord. Then the second new section, which deals with the rights and obligations of landlords, section 4B, sub 1. Landlord shall have the right to apply to a tribunal for an exemption to provide a written receipt as contemplated in section 4A, 1. Subsection 2. A landlord may require a tenant before moving into the dwelling to pay a deposit which A. may not exceed an amount equivalent to an amount specified in the agreement or otherwise agreed to between the parties. B. must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution, provided that the rate applicable to such account may not be less than the rate applicable to a savings account with that financial institution. And C. must, subject to sections 4 or 7, be repaid to the tenant with such interest as the rate applicable to such account on the expiration of the lease as contemplated in sections 4 or 7. Subsection 4 deals with the when there are damages done and the tenant attended the inspection, and 7 deals where the tenant did not attend the inspection. Sub 3. Upon request from the tenant during the period of the lease, the landlord must provide him or her with written proof in respect of interest accrued on the deposit referred to in section 2, provided that where the landlord is a registered estate agent as provided for in the Estate Agency Affairs Act 1976, Act No. 112 of 1976, the deposit and any interest thereon shall be dealt with in accordance with the provisions of that Act. 4. On the expiration of the lease, the landlord A. must, where no amounts are due and owing to the landlord in terms of the lease, the deposit, together with the accrued interest in respect thereof, refund to the tenant without any deduction or set-up within 7 days of expiration of the lease. B. may apply such deposit and interest towards the payment of all amounts for which the tenant is liable under the said lease, including the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling during the lease period and the cost of replacing lost keys and the balance of the deposit and interest. Over to page 11, if any, must then be refunded to the tenant by the landlord not later than 14 days after the restoration of the dwelling to the landlord, and C, must make available to the tenant for inspection the relevant receipts which indicate the costs which the landlord incurred as contemplated in Section 4B as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. 5. The tenant and the landlord must jointly, before the tenant moves into the dwelling, inspect the dwelling to ascertain the existence or not of any defects or damage therein, with a view to determining the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defects or damage, or with a view to registering such defects or damage as provided for in Section 5, sub 7. You will note that this is a repeat of what was said in 4A, and the reason for this repeat is simply that it is made clear in 4A that we are dealing with the rights and obligations of tenants. The same right and obligation in respect of the inspection has a counterpart on the landlord, which is then contained in Section 4B. So even though it is a duplication to a large extent, the reason for that is so that the Act is made more accessible to landlords and to tenants. I will continue. Have I read 6 already? At 6. Okay, thank you. I thought, I'm not sure if I've read 6 now. It doesn't feel like it. It's such a lot of read to go to still. Subsection 6. At the expiration of the lease, the landlord and tenant must arrange a joint inspection of the dwelling at a mutually convenient time to take place within a period of 3 days prior to such expiration, with a view to ascertaining if there was any damage caused to the dwelling during the tenant's occupation thereof, provided that A. Failure by the landlord to inspect the dwelling in the presence of the tenant as contemplated in Section 6, this means when the tenant vacates the property, is deemed to be an acknowledgement by the landlord that the dwelling is in a good and proper state of repair, and the landlord will have no further claim against the tenant, who must then be refunded in terms of the subsection the full deposit plus interest by the landlord. Or B, should the tenant fail to respond to the landlord's request for an inspection as contemplated in Section 6, the landlord must, on expiration of the lease, inspect the dwelling within 7 days from such expiration in order to assess any damages or loss which occur during the tenancy. 7. The landlord, in the circumstances contemplated in Section 6B, without detracting from any other right or remedy of the landlord A, may deduct from the tenant's deposit and interest the reasonable costs of repairing damage to the dwelling and the cost of replacing lost keys, must refund the balance of the deposit and interest, if any, after deduction of the amounts contemplated in paragraph A to the tenant not later than 21 days after expiration of the lease. Over to page 12. C. Must make available the relevant receipts which indicate the costs which the landlord incurred, as contemplated in paragraph A, to the tenant for inspection as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. Sub 8. Should the tenant vacate the dwelling before expiration of the lease without notice to the landlord, the lease is deemed to have expired on the date that the landlord established that the tenant had vacated the dwelling, but in such event, the landlord retains all his or her rights arising from the tenant's breach of the lease. Sub 9. Landlords may inspect the dwelling during the course of the lease, but in doing so must respect tenant's rights to privacy during the lease period and may only exercise his or her right of inspection in a reasonable manner after reasonable notice to the tenant. 10. Landlord's rights against tenants include his or her right to A, prompt and regular payment of rental or any charges that may be payable in terms of the lease, B, recover unpaid rental or any other amount that is due and payable where the tenant fails or refuses to make payment on demand after obtaining a ruling by the tribunal or an order of a court of law, C, terminate the lease in respect of rental housing property on grounds that do not constitute an unfair practice and are specified in the lease, D, on termination of the lease, 1, have the tenant vacate the property immediately upon expiration of the lease and to receive the rental housing property in a good state of repair, safe or fair wear and tear, and 2, where the tenant fails or refuses to vacate the dwelling, repossess the rental housing property having first obtained an order of court. The wording in the beginning of paragraph 2 has been added because there have been some public comments concerned about the wording repossess and whether that means that the landlord, even if there is normal expiration of a lease, has to repossess with a court order, which just didn't seem logical. The correct thus inserted, the repossession with an order of court is only if the tenant fails or refuses to vacate. E, claim compensation for damage to the rental housing property or any other improvements on the land on which the dwelling is situated and, if any, caused by the tenant, a member of the tenant's household, or a visitor of the tenant. Sub 11, landlords must ensure that the provisions of sections 5, 6, 7 and 8 regarding the lease are complied with. 6, 7 and 8 deals with certain requirements in regarding to the lease, and we will see that now. 12, landlords must maintain the structure of and provision of utilities to the dwelling. Just to remind you that this is one of the words where the word maintain is used, and therefore this must refers to keep the house in a habitable state. Over to page 13. Section 5, the amendment to subsection 1 is to address a concern that the committee has where landlords or tenants simply do not adhere to the terms of their agreement, and then the other party cannot prove that something was in fact a term of the agreement. Therefore, the committee said, no, leases must be in writing, even if it is one page. So we have addressed subsections 1, 2, as well as subsection 6, which deals with the necessary content of a lease. Subsection 1 will now read, a lease between a tenant and a landlord must be in writing, but will not be subject to the provisions of the formalities in respect of Leases of Land Act, 1969 Act No. 18 of 1969. 2, a landlord must reduce the lease to writing and must ensure that it contains the information set out in Section 6. 3, this has been amended because all the...
Thank you, Chairperson. Regarding Section 5, Subsection 2, there seems to be a duplication. In Subsection 1, you're already saying a lease must be in writing. We've corrected that. We've taken out the part that was saying it need not need to be in writing. Now, if you read Subsection 2, it's still saying the same. It's saying a landlord must reduce the lease to writing. And the other thing, Chairperson, I was looking at subsection 6. Subsection 6 is just stating what the lease must include, the information which must be included in the lease. Now, thinking, having that in mind, Chairperson, it seems as if subsection 2 is no longer necessary. Because if you read the original one, it was saying a landlord, if requested by the tenant, must reduce the lease for writing. Now, there's no need to have this if already we have already corrected in subsection 1 to say a lease must be writing. That's what I wanted to clarify, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honorable Bowman.
Chairperson, yes. I think we should just have a little bit of thought in this because whilst I hear what you're saying, I think that in point number 2, it actually says, and must ensure that it contains the information set out, which is not included in point number 1. And I think with us trying to cover all our tracks with the vulnerable people, and I think this is the point, it may be a little bit extra, but we're just trying to emphasize that.
Clarification from the legal unit.
Thank you, Chairperson. Subsection 2, in fact, serves two purposes. The one is to indicate that the lease, which must be in writing, must in fact be reduced to writing by the landlord. In other words, this is an obligation placed on the landlord. That is something that we can incorporate into subsection 1. It should not be too difficult to include that in subsection 1 and then delete subsection 2. But, as Honourable Borman has said, it is a little bit difficult because we want to say it must contain the information set out in Section 6. And if we want to include that into 1, we can, but we'll have to create subparagraphs. So the committee can lead us on that. If we are going to keep 2, we might as well keep it as it is now. If the committee would want us to combine 1 and 2, I think the only way we'll be able to do that is by paragraphs.
Can you speak to subsection 6? because there's also reflected to subsection. Let me ask you, we approve.
Thank you, Chairperson. Subsection 6, simply indicate what is the content that must be included.
Chair, yes, I agree with both points of view. And whilst I think it is a repetition, I also agree that we'd rather emphasize and point to a particular section of information that the lease must contain than leave out subsection 2, for example, and then later you get to the lease must contain this. So right at the front where we insisting that it must be in writing by the landlord, we then also draw attention to what it must include. So yes, it is a repetition, but I don't think there's any harm if we in fact leave it as it is. If we start changing one, it's going to become a little bit messy.
Oh, I think what we can suggest, they can just make sub-clauses.
Yes, Chairperson, I hear what is being explained. Perhaps we can just remove the reference to writing to just say a landlord must ensure that the lease contains the information set out in subsection 6, just to put that emphasis, but we remove the word it must be in writing because it's already been stated in subsection 1.
Nina Magqwetha, you will go and sit down. Don't involve us on this matter. Tina, we want this to be inserted. Tina, as the committee, our interest is one, and it's clear. Nina, as legal persons or expertise, I am giving you that opportunity to go and sit and modify this. Otherwise, we want all these things to be inserted in this legislation. That's the bottom line. That's all. Okay, Shami.
Thank you, Chairperson. We will basically then take that comment on board, and we will see how we can retain all the information, but maybe, yes, but maybe just do it in one subsection.
Sorry, just on that, I think it's important because subsection 1, just refers to a lease. It doesn't give the responsibility to any specific party. Subsection 2, in addition to saying it must be in writing, gives that responsibility to the landlord. And I would strongly argue that it stays as it is, rather than having other sub-clauses or subsections in one. It can be amended slightly, so you take out reduced to writing, but make it very clear that it's a responsibility of the landlord and it must include the information set up in Section 6.
In dialogue, Mr. I check.
I'm coming.
Oh, sorry, I will then proceed to subsection 3. Subsection 3 has been amended because all the paragraphs contained here is now contained in sections 4A and 4B, which I've already read. Subsection 3 will now read, a lease will be deemed to include terms enforceable in a tribunal or competent court, setting out the rights of tenants and landlords referred to in sections 4A and 4B. All these paragraphs on page 13, 14, and the top bit of 15 will then be deleted. And section 5 will then continue with subsections 4, 5, and 6, which deals with the lease, which is in fact the heading of section 5. In subsection 6, because all leases must now be reduced to writing, the committee also felt that it is necessary to make sure that this can be a one-page document and doesn't have to be 20 or 30 pages, which will just go against the object of having it in writing. So in that regard, in subsection 6, four amendments are made, and I will read those amendments. Subsection B, the description of the dwelling which is the subject of the lease, provided that a street address will be sufficient. If paragraph FA is inserted, A statement acknowledging the rights and obligations of the tenant and landlord in terms of Section 4A, 4B, and the regulations relating to unfair practice. Subparagraph FA simply means that instead of having to repeat all these rights and obligations, tenants and landlords can simply refer to these two sections, and they will then be deemed part of that agreement. Very, very clearly, parties can see that they are, in fact, included. G, any other obligations of the tenant and landlord not set out in Sections 4A, 4B, or the regulations relating to unfair practice. This amendment has been made so that it is not necessary to keep to state every single obligation that might rest on either party. H, identification and the amount of any other charges payable in addition to the rental in respect of the property. Subsection 7, a list of defects registered in terms of Sections 4A, 5 and 4B5 must be attached as an annexure to the lease as contemplated in Subsection 2. This is simply a consequential amendment. Then Subsection 9 is deleted because it is included in Section 4B. The next amendment is in Chapter 4, Section 6. This is an amendment that was part of the bill as introduced. Section 6 will now read, application of chapter. This chapter applies to all provinces in the Republic of South Africa. Over on page 17, Section 7, establishment of rental housing tribunals. This is partly an amendment as was introduced, but also some additional amendments, and this amendment, in fact, has already been discussed with the department. Section 7 will now read, every MEC must, within the first financial year following on the commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012, by notice in the Gazette, establish a tribunal in the province to be known as the Rental Housing Tribunal. This simply means that provinces will have one budget term in which to establish their rental tribunals. The next section amended is 9. The committee members felt that composition might be a little bit of a legal term and preferred the word membership of the tribunal. This amendment is also something that is actually introduced by the department and has already been discussed by the department. Section 9, subsection 1, will now read, the tribunal consists of 7 members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the MEC and must comprise A, has not been amended, the chairperson, B, which has been amended, 6 members, of whom, 1, 2 shall be persons with expertise in property management or housing development matters, 2 shall be persons with expertise in consumer matters pertaining to rental housing or housing development matters, and 3, 2 shall be persons with legal qualifications. The next amendment is the insertion of 6 subsection 1B. This is also something...
I'd in fact like to hear the comments from the state law advisors. All other legislation, to my knowledge to date, when we refer to a body that make up a board or anything like that, at the moment refers to the composition. I know we discussed that, and even at the time when we discussed it, I wasn't very comfortable with membership. So in fact, I'd just like comment from the state law advisors with regard to changing composition to membership. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, Chairperson, indeed, the normal phrase which is used in other legislation when you're setting up a body, you say a composition because you are setting up a body and then you are indicating what if this body will be made up of. Hence, we're starting by saying a tribunal consists of. And then membership gives a different meaning.
Can you define membership?
Also, membership chairperson, it refers to the members of the tribunal. But the content, because if you put a heading, you're trying to indicate what are you going to see from the heading. From the content of the heading. You are guided by the heading. If you look at the heading, automatically you know what is going to be contained in this clause or in this section. Now, if you look at membership, then you will think that it will deal also with members of the tribunal. I don't know, Chairperson, but the bottom line, Chairperson, you are talking to the body that you're setting up, and then you are indicating what will this body be made up of? Hence you're saying composition. But there's no wrong, even if you're saying membership. But I was just saying the intention of spearheading is...
The common word. Commonly.
Sometimes you say the constitution, you're saying constitution of something, which is different, which is similar to composition.
I can't understand. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do this.
Thank you, Chairperson.
No, I'm
don't
have a problem. But then I found who convinced us that the red text is not a it differs. Just say we wanted to differ. We don't have to differ for the sake of differing. But if it's a common word, you can agree that it's a common word. But it must not be something for the sake of differing. Eric?
Thank you, Chairperson. In the Skills Development Amendment Bill, I'm not sure if it's an act yet, they speak about CETAs and the membership of the CETAs, of the board of the CETAs. So that's a new development in legislation. Because composition refers to just how those boards or tribunals, what they're composed of, or how many members, whereas membership takes it further to say this is what they're allowed to do, this is their function, etc. So membership encompasses more than just composition.
We have given us the indication, and Lendo, we have been discussing that. And China, in his way, said you are taking membership. But the Sovereign is equal to the sort of committee. See, what else? Which one are we taking?
Thank you, Chairperson. The next insertion is subsection 1B. This is also something that has already been discussed with the department. The members of the tribunal must be broadly representative in terms of gender, race, and disability. The next amendment is in subsection 2B. So that subsection 2 reads, the chairperson and members of the tribunal must be appointed only after B, the MEC has consulted with the relevant standing or portfolio committee of the provincial legislature, which is responsible for human settlements. This is also something that has already been discussed with the department. Subsection 3 deals with alternates, and based on an internal appeal process, which the committee felt is necessary for tribunals, the committee also felt that it was necessary to expand on the number of alternates that can be appointed for tribunal members. Subsection 3 is just proposed to read, the MEC may appoint up to 6 persons to serve as alternate members of the tribunal in the absence of any member referred to in paragraphs B, 1, 2, and 3 of subsection 1 respectively. But such persons must have the relevant expertise contemplated in paragraphs B, 1, 2, and 3 of subsection 1 respectively. The next amendment is the insertion of subsection 4A. This is also an amendment that has already been made as in the bill as introduced. A person appointed referred to in subsection 4 may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms. There was a little bit of a concern about the transfer of skill and knowledge, and therefore the committee proposes 2 new sections under section 4A. 4B, succession plans must be adopted and must provide for replacement of members in such a manner that for the sake of continuity, all members are not replaced as once. 4C, where members already appointed at the time of commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012 have already served 2 consecutive terms, the succession plan must provide for replacement of such members over an 18-month period to ensure continuity.
I'm looking at subsection 4C. Yes, that subsection is a transitional provision because it is catering for something which has already occurred. It's catering for the members who had already served for more than 2 consecutive terms. Now, Chairperson, I was going to propose as follows. I'm going to read. Members already appointed at the time of commencement of the Rental Housing Act 2012 and who have already served two consecutive terms may be reappointed for additional period of 18 months to ensure continuity. I'm proposing, Chairperson, because I'm looking because in subsection 2B, you are talking of a succession plan, which still must be formed. So I was going to think that perhaps it's up to the committee. Is it not better if you set it in the legislation because you are the legislature, you are the one who are making laws, and also in this instance, since you have already indicated above that the appointment must not exceed 3 years, and if it has expired, they may be reappointed by the MEC for additional period of 3 years that you've already indicated in the legislation. And here you are providing for the similar situation where the term has expired. The two conservative terms have already expired. You are catering for a situation to cover for those people in order to ensure continuity, so that when the term has ended at the commencement of this bill now, of this bill, now already they may be reappointed for additional term, instead of leaving it to the succession plan. Succession 2B is fine, 4B is fine, because it's catering for something that is going to happen in the future for new members. But for C, I would propose that you should read as I've proposed. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, I don't think there's a problem on that one, because our argument was that this legislation, although we agree that it's not going to be retrospective, but now if the MEC start appointing the members after this legislation has been promulgated, it means maybe he's going to get all new members and then come the end of the term. So it means all those members should move. So I think as long as you are going to make sure that at least that part is taken care of. So you can sort it out together. I don't think it's a problem. Okay.
Chairperson, how long is the term?
Oh,
it's 3 years.
Oh, okay. Because we have said, okay.
Chairperson, as may have acknowledged, we will correspond with the State Law Advisor. The next amendment over on page 19 is in section 10. Section 10.1, this amendment has already been discussed with the department and part of it is in fact as the bill is as introduced. Section 1 will read, the tribunal must meet on such days and during such hours and at such place as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine, after consultation with other members of the tribunal. Then the next inserted section 1A has also been discussed with the department, and it reads, the tribunal may, subject to sections 10.2B, which deals with the deputy chairperson, and 10.5, which deals with quorum, arrange two simultaneous meetings in different areas for purposes of effective functioning. So the wording geographical there was initially considered to be part of this amendment, and we've just deleted it. I will delete it in the correct.
Chairperson, can I clarify in this instance? I will explain why. I just want to get the understanding. Are we extending the? Because I understand the tribunal when they sit in order to consider the complaint. Now I'm trying to understand if you're saying they may have two simultaneous meetings in different areas. Are we talking about the tribunals? Because tribunals, there's only one tribunal per province. Are we talking about joining? I don't understand. I just want to get clarity on that. Are we joining Cape Town, Gauteng, and there's two simultaneous meetings?
No. We are referring to one tribunal. Let's take an Eastern Cape tribunal. We have extended the number of the tribunal, and the reason for that, we said, in fact, in our deliberations together with the department, those members, there has to be an instance where they have to split depending on the cases that they have received. You go and hear, this team goes to Matatiel and hear, have a hearing there. And then the other one goes to Port Alfred. When they have heard, they will have a sitting of the tribunal and present those different reports so that a decision is taken by one tribunal. That is why we are saying we are expanding their numbers, because we want Ukuthandoz, they have to be fast-tracked a problem. There's a complaint. So that is the reason why we are saying so. I'm sure you understand, my daughter. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. I think just to add in there is that the real intention in there is not to propose, you know, two tribunals. What they're trying to do, I say, is only the meeting. It says that the tribunal may arrange two simultaneous meetings. I say that a tribunal of a particular province may arrange two meetings, you know, simultaneously. So we're not proposing to say that there should be two tribunals, but a tribunal itself may propose two meetings of the particular tribunal.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to make a proposal that will hopefully make it a little bit clearer. When we discussed it yesterday, we agreed that geographical will be taken out because there is the possibility in a province, say, like the Western Cape or Gauteng, for that matter, they may very well sit, two tribunals composing of three each may sit in the same building and possibly even on the same floor in different rooms. And that's why we agreed to take out the word geographical. I want to propose that we now say the tribunal may, subject to sections 10.2b and 10.5, arrange two separate but simultaneous meetings for purposes of effective functioning. And we take out the different areas completely because it pretty much was in line with geographical. Two separate but simultaneous meetings for purposes of effective functioning. Then it covers whether they're in the same building, on the same floor, in two different parts of the province or whatever.
Yeah, I would actually like to make a further proposal. I think the comment from the state law advisor is actually very good because she comes in from the cold on this aspect. And I'm just now concerned that maybe we are not as clear with what we want to say with this. And I would like to propose that we maybe indicate that the tribunal, one tribunal, may form two committees within itself, and that these committees may sit separately but simultaneously. So maybe just to add that, so that it becomes quite clear what we intend.
I'm trying to be clear, Chairperson. If you're having, if you're saying it's simultaneous meetings, they're going to be in one room. But at the same time, okay, at the same time, but separate. Yeah, they're separate. Yes. Yeah. But it's second time. Yeah, but if it's a separate people. I said, but it's a separate people. We are confused with this.
You just read that again, please, Shamir.
Gee, I'm not 100% sure of the wording yet, but it will be, I think we'll probably insert a section 1B as well. So that 1A will probably read, the tribunal may form two committees of its members, subject to section 10.5, which refers to the quorum of three. And then 1B will read, the committees of the tribunal may, subject to sections 10.2b and 10.5, arrange two separate but simultaneous meetings for purposes of effective functioning.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am. I would just like to make a note so I don't forget what I've said.
But supposing I will discuss with Charmaine that proposal, we're still going to discuss that. Yes, Chairperson. Yes.
Sorry, Chair. We can have separate meetings, but not simultaneous. Because when it says simultaneous, it forces these people to be on separate meetings at the same time. So it can be separate. You know, these committees might sit, today might sit another committee somewhere, and tomorrow another committee somewhere. So it, the word simultaneous must not be inserted. Because the main aim here is to have separate committees at the same time to be able to deal with the caseload.
Chair, I think with respect, that doesn't deliver what we're aiming to do. The idea is if they're going to split and then still meet at different days, you may as well have the full tribunal sitting. The whole idea was that where there's a big caseload, you can split the one tribunal into two, and if they have to sit on the same day in separate rooms hearing different cases, that is the purpose of trying to make it more effective. So we're not saying they must, we're saying they may very well sit on the same day, either in two separate areas of the province, in the same building, whatever. Or they may not do that, but it just gives them the allowance to actually get through caseloads if they've got a heavy caseload. So I would argue that the word simultaneous needs to stay.
Chairperson, yes, I want to go back to your ruling, actually, that the two parties sit down together and just tweak that a little bit so that it is clear. You know what our feelings are.
Yes. As long as our content is not changed, that's all. Tinasigade nje umhlaba ongcwele. Umhlaba ongcwele, yes, the holy land. You must not touch it. Thank you, but this is the content. The holy land is the content.
Thank you, Chairperson. We will definitely sit with the state law advisor, but I also think my proposal of stipulating that these committees will address the problem with simultaneous, because then committees can sit more than once. It is like this committee is part of the National Assembly, but consisting of committees. So it will be a similar issue. Exactly, as Gary just said, it is still the work of the National Assembly, even though it happens through a committee. The next amendment is in subsection 3. That is simply as per section 11, clause 11 of the amendment bill, to change local authority to local municipality. Subsection 5 deals with the quorum. This has partly been amended already by the department, and a slight change has been made, and I will read it out and then explain the change. The quorum of any meeting of the tribunal is 3 members, of which at least 2 must be members appointed in terms of A, section 9, 1B1, that has been deleted, section 9, 1B3, which is someone with legal expertise, and B, section 9, 1B1 or 2. The reason for this is that part of this splitting process is also to make a provision for an internal appeal, so that the appeal is not heard by the same, if I may now refer to them as the same committee of the tribunal. But provided that each of these committees must at least have a legal person present. The next amendment, you'll be glad to know that we are skipping a couple of pages. We go to page 23. Paragraph B at the top of page 23 is simply the changing again of authority to municipality. And then paragraph C is we've inserted the words amongst others simply to make it clear that list there of the rulings that the tribunal may make is not exhaustive. So paragraph C will read, make any other ruling that is just and fair to terminate any unfair practice, including without detracting from the generality of the foregoing, a ruling to discontinue amongst others, 1, overcrowding, 2, unacceptable living conditions, 3, exploitative rentals, or 4, lack of maintenance. The next amendment is in section 5, paragraph A. This deals with the determination of rent payable by the tenant and what the tribunal must take into account. and paragraph A will now read, prevailing economic conditions. The wording supply and demand has been deleted because the committee felt that currently supply and demand is giving a skewed view of the market. There might be high demand for low-cost rental housing, which pushes the price up and actually totally goes against what we need. So when the tribunal looks at rent and the fairness of rent, they must keep in mind economic conditions. That is definitely something that they need to keep in mind. But someone cannot say that I'm charging R1,000 for a room that cannot even hold, like the chairperson says, a double bed, simply because that is the demand in an urban area and not in the area where the house is. And the next amendment is to Section 11. Section 10A, that you will see on page 24, was something proposed by the department, and the committee has asked, since subsection 11 is being deleted, that 10A simply be inserted in subsection 11. Now, both of these deal with referral by one party to the other, and therefore we have simply placed that into section 11. So section 11 will now read, the tribunal must, within 30 days of receipt of a complaint, refer any matter that relates to evictions to a competent court. The next amendment is to section 12, and the amendments to paragraphs B and C is simply to provide for the insertion of paragraphs D and E, so that subsection 12 reads, the tribunal may, D, subject to section 5, make a ruling to compel payment of rent as described and contracted to in a lease and arrear rentals, and E, in respect of any matter over which it has jurisdiction, make any order necessary to give effect to this act. 12A is inserted, and this was already done by the department. The tribunal may, acting on its own accord or on application by any affected person, rescind or vary any of its rulings if such ruling, over on page 25A, were erroneously sought or granted in the absence of the person affected by it, B, contain an ambiguity or patent error or omission, but only to the extent of clarifying that ambiguity or correcting that error or omission, or C, were granted as a result of a mistake common to all parties to the proceedings. There has been some concern about this power given to two tribunals, but the committee felt that this is a very important power that is given to tribunals, and therefore we have simply tried to clarify a little bit by the insertion of sections 12B and 12C, which reads, 12B, the tribunal may act on its own accord when it is supplementing accessory or consequential matters, including A, cost orders, B, altering an order for costs where it was made without hearing the parties, C, interest on ruling debts, D, clarification of ruling so as to give effect to the tribunal's true intention, E, correcting clerical, arithmetical, or other errors in its ruling, provided that any substantive change to a ruling must be made within 14 days of the ruling being made. The wording of this section is something that we got from some court cases, actually. So we have looked at what the courts have said that they can change by themselves, and this is what the courts have said. 12C, an application for rescission or variation must be brought within 14 days of a ruling being received by the affected person. The next amendment is in Section 14, which deals with information officers. Section 1 now reads, every local municipality must establish a rental housing information office to advise tenants and landlords with regard to their rights and obligations in relation to dwellings within its area of jurisdiction. Provided that local municipalities, and yesterday we considered the level 3, so that will just be deleted, but it will now read, provided that local municipalities may combine the functions of the rental housing information office with an existing office. 2. Every municipality may, subject to the laws governing the appointment of local government officials, appoint or designate officials to carry out any duties pertaining to such rental housing information office. Subsection 2 was an amendment and the bill as introduced. The next amendment is on page 26 to section 15, which deals with regulations. I would, because of some some concern by the committee members yesterday when I dealt with this, I would like to read section 3 on page 28 first. A new section is to be inserted into this section 15, and it will read, the minister must issue regulations as contemplated in sections 1B, S, FA, and FB within 12 months of the commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012. So there are certain regulations which the minister must issue. If we then go back to page 26, subsection 1 is then amended to read, subject to section 3, which I've just read, the minister may make regulations after consultation with the relevant parliamentary committees and every MEC by notice in the Gazette relating to. In other words, the minister must consult, but he is not forced to make regulations on everything that is listed. And the reason for that is there's a paragraph here that says anything which may or must be prescribed. It is quite clear that you can't say the minister must regulate on that. Therefore, that has been changed and certain specific regulations have been identified in Section 3. Paragraph A has been made a little bit broader so that it is not just Chapter 4, but everything in this Act. B is now including the process for appeal. So the paragraph B reads, the procedures and manner in which the proceedings of the tribunal must be conducted, including circumstances and process for submitting an appeal. The next amendment is on page 27, which includes two new paragraphs, FA and FB, three, and FC. FA reads, circumstances that will be regarded as urgent for purposes of section 1310. 1310 deals with instances where the courts have concurrent jurisdiction with tribunals, and one of those is where there is urgent matters. And the committee felt that this could be open for abuse, and therefore it would be good if the minister actually indicates what would be regarded as urgent where courts will have concurrent jurisdiction. FB, and this is maybe more for the committee members now, you will see that it is almost fully blue. And I'm hoping that we won't feel blue about this after today. We have looked at, you will recall that Gary found some European Union standards on housing, etc. Now, we've looked at the article, and it deals actually with government's responsibility relating to housing and the right to housing in the European Union. But we found that we could borrow from that. So this is what we've borrowed, and this is now how we propose it would read. Norms and standards that are aligned to the policy framework set out in Section 2.3 related to, and we've actually broadened it now, not only related to rent. We've broadened it to say, one, terms and conditions of the lease, specifically in relation to fairness and protection of the weaker contract party. Two, safety, health, and hygiene. Three, basic living functions, including access to basic amenities. Four, size. Five, overcrowding. And six, affordability, provided that such norms and standards may be set per geographical area. So we've removed the wording at the top where we looked at geographical areas and rather said at the bottom it may differ in respect of areas. But this will that the minister must, because this is in terms of Section 3, one of the issues the minister must issue regulations on. So the minister will set out norms and standards on not just the rental aspect, which is under the affordability, which it's a little bit broader than rent, because it takes rent into account in relation to economic circumstances, in relation to size, in relation to social development, etc. So the committee might feel that the word affordability is maybe not clear enough, not strong enough, and then we'll just have to look at that. But we've tried to take into consideration the fear that the committee said, or the concern rather, that we don't want rent control. This is not what we're aiming at. So if we need to rethink that word, we can still think about that a bit, but that is where we thought to cover rent under affordability. And then FC, the offences referred to in Section 16. So this will allow the minister, where offences have been described in Section 16, to simply indicate what type of actions could be regarded as an offence and whether there should be certain standards in respect of penalties. Then Section 3 on page 28, I have already read, and I will proceed to Section 16, offences and penalties. We have deleted the all 9 in paragraph A, simply that is a consequential amendment that that subsection has now been deleted and forms part of 4B. Then we have added AA and AB, which reads, any person who, AA, willfully or grossly negligently interferes with the rights of the tenant and landlord set out in sections 4A1, 3, 7, 8, and 9, and sections 4B9, 10B, 10C, and 10D1, or willfully or grossly negligently fails to fulfill his or her obligations as landlord in terms of sections 4B2, C, and 12 respectively, will then in the end commit an offence. I would just like to take you through all those different sections so that you know what we're referring to. AA, the rights interfered with, we refer to the right to have a written receipt, the right to receive payment of the deposit with interest, the right to privacy, the right to have this right to privacy extended to visitors, as well as the right not to have his or her home searched, property seized. Then in respect of the rights of the landlord, we're looking at the right to inspect, subject to the right to privacy, the right to recover unpaid rent. Initially, the Act indicated that the payment of rent becomes an offence. We have changed that now, so it is the right to recover that rent that you may not interfere with. The next right is to terminate the lease if there is just circumstances, and the right to have the tenant vacate the property. Then in respect of the obligations of the landlord, what would constitute a crime, an offence, would be not repaying the deposit, that is 4B to C. Paying it back with interest, and 12 is to maintain the property. And again, the reference to the definition of maintain, which is that it must be maintained in a habitable condition. Then the next amendment is to paragraph G. The deletion there of in terms of section 13.4 is so that any ruling of the tribunal which is not complied with will constitute an offence. The committee felt that this will give the tribunal a little bit more oomph in case we miss a ruling that it may make somewhere. This will simply mean that every single ruling must be complied with or you will be committing an offence. The next amendment and the last amendment is on page 29, and this is the internal appeal process that has now been provided for. Section 17 is amended to read appeal and review. Subsection 1 reads, without prejudice to the constitutional right of any person to gain access to a court of law, A, an application to appeal the ruling of the tribunal may be submitted to the tribunal within 21 days after notice of the ruling was received by the person intending to file an application for appeal, and B, the proceedings of the tribunal, including appeal proceedings, may be brought under review before the High Court within its area of jurisdiction. Subsections 2 and 3 have been inserted. The members of the tribunal who made the ruling may not hear the appeal, and where necessary, the chairperson must appoint alternate members in terms of Section 9.3 to hear the appeal. This is simply to provide for objectivity as far as possible. Subsection 3, the minister must prescribe the circumstances under which an application for an appeal may be submitted. This paragraph A is to avoid frivolous appeals, so that there's only certain aspects on which an appeal may be brought. B, the procedure to submit an appeal, which may include first obtaining consent to appeal from the members of the tribunal who made the ruling. And those are all the proposed amendments to the Principal Act. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Regarding the appeals and reviews, I understand that is an internal appeal process that is being set up by the committee. But my concern, Chairperson, is upon reading this provision, you are the aggrieved party will appeal to the same tribunal, even though I understand you're gonna separate the committees of the tribunals. But my concern is you're appealing to the same authority. The general rule, Chairperson, is that if you are aggrieved by the decision of a lower body, you appeal to the higher authority. And in the internal processes, in terms of the legislation, you are, if you are aggrieved by the decision of a lower body, you would appeal to the minister or a body which is set up specifically to deal with appeals. Such a person, I would advise against insertion of such proposal and come with an alternative suggestion that will count for the appeals if you are aggrieved by the decision of the tribunal, regardless of whether it's from one committee or the other committee, but still it's one tribunal. If you are aggrieved, then you appeal to the chairperson. Thank you, chairperson.
Bongi, I was a substrat for quite a long time, and I've been a victim for quite a long time. When you are charged, I think it's similar. You are suspended by a hospital manager, just to cite an example. And then when time comes for your hearing, the hospital manager is going to appoint a chairperson. Not himself, going to appoint a chairperson. That is an internal mechanism. And then that decision or the ruling of that independent chairperson is not in favor of the complainant. You place an appeal in the same institution, but there is a higher body in that institution. No, I'm just listening. For instance, if you are, it's a hospital, so you appeal to that manager, but the appeals chairperson is going to be somebody who's taken from outside of the institution itself. So why we are saying there has to be this internal mechanism? Go back to the sectional title. Because what we are trying to curb here is people who have got money who are going to abuse the vulnerable. Let the complaint head. There have to be internal processes. And then if those internal processes, that it is only one internal process, so that the tribunal refer the matter to the court now, if it has not been resolved by the internal processes. If you remember, Father Sisenza, subject to music. But as long as you are going to come up with something that is going to address that, that's what we want. Try and limit the court cases. But we are not saying nazo mazenzeke, kodwa masizilimite. It's analon dog. But later I won't go to Aiz Rahuse, Kota Funerawana, Ni Sanganisil, Sangansan, is a reboot.
Now, Shabbos, what I was saying is the appeals must be made to the minister. It's still internal process, not the same body. It would not be legally correct.
Ah, okay, Utetile and Tumba. The one of we validating accepted. I don't think as members of the problem.
I agree with Bongi. I just want some clarity. Should we make all appeals to the minister, or should we make it to the MEC in that province?
Yes, Chairperson, I'll have to check the Act, because the Act contains for the MECs and the ministers. I'll have to check to see whether it should be referred to the MEC or the minister, but that person should be the last resort. And the decision of the minister or the MEC will be final. Thanks, Chairperson.
No, thank you very much, Shami. I also want to check from the department. In your experience, there's that exemption that was given to the landlord for not issuing a receipt. In your experience, what is the criteria that can be used to exempt that particular person? Because you were here last time when I was narrating sharing my experience when I was in one of the shops during my constituency period, where the caretaker was charging the tenants one by one to say, you are going to pay 1,000 rand, 1,000 rand, 1,000, something that was not even in the agreement. And another thing that they were fighting for. This lady was saying they must give her money. And then they were saying, no, we're not going to give you cash. We're going to put the money in the bank so that we keep our slips. And then when what you can do, we can give you the copy of the bank slip. So this means there is a problem. So I want to know from the department why there has been this clause. Maybe you would understand why there has been this clause of exemption.
That proposal, Chairperson, was made during the 2007 amendment. It was made by the committee. And I think it was coming from one of the tribunals who said maybe in some instances it won't be possible to prevent that receipt. But then it was proposed here at by the committee. Thanks, Chairperson.
In the department, please, from your reports, any demand and other challenges from the tribunal. Ikona Londo.
Not really, Chairperson, unless maybe if we, we of course consult with the tribunal themselves, so that they have experienced a particular challenge. But like we've indicated to say that there's been, I think in 2007, the rationale for that amendment was basically to give, an exemption to those who cannot produce at a particular point in time, because we are talking about the other means. Some people that they are issued with the receipt at a point in time, depending on the different point which, they...
What is a receipt? Into a casa, into a mana, imali ndi unikile. A casa, uti, mna imali ndi ifumene. That's it. What is difficult to give a person a receipt? Because you just take a piece of paper, you don't even go and buy that receipt book. You can get a piece of paper and say, so much paid, you sign, and I sign. But what is important, the receipt has to be there. When there is an exchange of money, you can't have given a change of money and then there's no receipt. I lay on the Kululu, you know, daughter, no man, men, daughter. The receipt must be there. You can't do any business. Renting is a business. Whether you rent one house, one room in your house, so you have started an Italian, what is it called, an entrepreneurship. That is business. So you must provide something. Those receipts, we don't want those receipts as a stamp issue, but there has to be a proof that I've given you money. Or if you don't give me, I'm not going to give you cash. I'm going to put it in the bank. And then what are you going to say? That was defined practically. I observed it during this constituency period in December I was in one of those shops. There was a good fight there, and the police were there.
Just to assist the COVID, I think the rationale at that point in time was with respect to it depends as to whether where the payment has been made, because at some point if the payment is made, you know, at certain institution, like for example, if it's paid, the deposit is paid, let me say, you know, somewhere, then you won't find if it's done electronically. We're talking about the other kind of things, person. I think at that point in time.
Tell me where is somewhere. Yes, I can meet you by the shop.
Yes.
And then I've got money by that particular. I said, where's, here is the rent. And then please, I'll come to your office. I'll come to your home. All you will bring. For instance, we are working here in Parliament. I want to make a practical example. We are using these shackles on a daily basis. Those people are picking up us from point A to point B, from our parks to airport. Sometimes that person doesn't have a receipt on that particular time. But they make it a point that they bring those receipts to our places. Because Mrs. Aleef is not going to reimburse you if you don't have a receipt. So I don't understand why is it so difficult to say, I paid my rent. Give me proof. Because tomorrow you can tell me that I have not paid the rent. Where am I going to complain?
Chairperson, as I was saying, the proposal was made by the tribunal. And I can't remember, but they explained that they are having challenges. I don't know what are those challenges. But
now we are challenging it. Now, can you come up? Is it right not to give me a receipt, whereas I paid you? Is it correct?
Let me finish. Chairperson,
it's not correct. Let's be clear about that. It's not correct.
It's not correct.
But Chairperson, the matter will be brought before the tribunal, because it says a tribunal may, in exceptional cases, not every.
The tribunal is not making the laws of this country. We are the lawmakers of the country. So we are seeing a problem. We have observed a problem. So the tribunal has to take whatever we are giving. We are not going to listen to them. No one said there are mistakes.
Just what about tax? We must have something. This one going up and down. This is of no use. We must have the receipt even for the question of tax. You can't just say, I will give you 200 rand without getting something back.
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to say, I don't think we need to argue so much about this, because it's very clear. You are giving them even the example here about our shackles. Not solely because Mrs. Aleef won't reimburse us, because it's just the witness that have given you money. Let me get a receipt. Why should it be so difficult to get a receipt after paying the rent? We have been paying, we have been renting for so long. And whenever I gave a person, a landlord, my money, I was just requesting my receipt, because it's landlord and a tenant. There will be a fight one day. Then I will show, saying, here are my receipts. What is he talking or she talking about? I think we need not to waste a lot of time here.
Thank you. Mr. Singh?
Thank you, Chair. I'm not even going to debate that. I think we've amended the Act so that receipts must be issued.
Yes.
Chair, there's just two or three small things that I still have a little bit of a uneasiness about me, and it's primarily, I want to hear from the legal people, if I may raise it quickly, Chair. On page page 28, when we say right at the top, that subsection 3, the minister must issue regulations. I'd just like to know, is there a difference between issue and promulgation? And in this instance, is issue the correct word there? Should it perhaps not be promulgate? So I'd like to hear from the legal people in terms of that. Do I wait for the answer, or can I just go on to the other issue, Chair? The other, and they both, the other one is on page 19, under the sub-clause, what's it, 10.5. The intention there is to make sure that one person in, of a three-member tribunal, for example, is a person with legal qualifications. But the way we've got it here now, it says of which at least two must be members, and then we include the criteria for the three. But our intention is that one must be with legal. So should we not change that to say of which one member must be appointed in terms of the 9.1(b)(3), and we leave out the other one because by default the other two will make up from the other parts. I'm a little bit concerned the way. Pardon, Chair? No, we're saying and that. So it doesn't make our intention very clear. I'm a bit worried that we may, whereas if we say of which a member must be appointed in terms of 9.1(b)(3). And then, again, just for the sake of clarity, on page 24, on 11, now, Chair, you know that we've had lots of problems with the PIE Act and with the Rental Tribunal Act, Rental Housing Act, in terms of evictions. We're very clear that we don't want the tribunal to be able to evict. On the other hand, it is very difficult for some people to go to court and get an eviction, and it's an expensive and long, drawn-out process. Now, we haven't really sorted that out, and we're hoping to do it when we amend the PIE Act. But in this 11... what I want clarity on is when a tribunal refers a matter to a competent court, is it any different to when an individual approaches a court? Or when we say the tribunal must refer it, will the tribunal purely tell the in this case, obviously, the landlord, we can't handle it, you must go to a court, in which case it follows the normal procedure. What I really want to know is, would this be some sort of a shortcut for the landlord to go to the court? If the tribunal refers it.
I'll start clarifying the last part on page 24. The intention there is to only refer matters that relate to eviction. You refer to the court, not any other matter. That was the intention.
It doesn't answer my question. I'm well aware that it's what I'm referring to is when does the tribunal refer? Are they purely going to tell the landlord, sorry, we can't deal with this, you must follow the procedures, or do they in fact in some procedure refer to a court?
I think because it is referred by the tribunal, there has to be a procedure for me. Because it's the tribunal that is referring. I don't know. Can you clarify that?
Thank you, Jefferson. I don't foresee that this would be a shortcut in any way because papers would need to be filed and steps would need to be followed. Well, civil procedure would need to be followed in order for that process to be fair and to grant certain people the right to apply, etc. So I don't see that this would be a... I can't foresee a situation where this would be a shortcut.
Let's discuss the regulations because the Act stipulates this. But the details, let's talk about them, good regulations.
Thank you, sir. I think the procedure pertaining to, you know, to that particular referral will be spelled out clearly in the procedure regulations dealing with this process because the Act also prescribes so that you need to develop those sets of regulations dealing with the procedures and also the unfair practice. Then the procedure will be spelled out in that.
Chairperson, maybe then just as a note for this committee, when the regulations are being reviewed by you or looked at by this committee, there will have to be some form of consultation with justice to make sure that the court makes special dispensation for something that is referred from a tribunal. Because otherwise, like Gary said, it would simply be, if the most I can see at the moment is that the tribunal will maybe take the papers and give that to the court. Court will still open a case, still has to be serviced, still has to be replied, nothing special. Mm-hmm. But perhaps with in consultation with justice, because they will have to agree to a new process being made available. It could be done by regulation, but just maybe as a mental note for this committee, when that comes, that is something that has to be looked at. The change on page 19, I think that will actually read quite well. We will definitely make that change. I think the last issue on the issue or the promulgate or the make, I'm going to put the state law advisor on the spot and ask her what would be the best word there to use.
Chairperson, this one is just to, you cannot say refer, you can just say the minister must prescribe. That's the word that is normally used in legislation. Must prescribe. We need to rework this paragraph, but the content we won't lose.
Thank you very much to all of us. We have to pet, but would like to hear a word at least from my children, the department at least, and the state law advisor at least, just a few comments on the work that has been done by the portfolio committee. Yes, let me give you that opportunity. I have been as a spectator, so I didn't get into any form. But it's any participating demos. It was a participatory process. But I think it is very, very important that we give you an opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair. I think the amendments as presented, to a certain extent, of course, we concur with some of the amendments, but however, I wish I could not to state on record to say that we as a department, we never had an opportunity, of course, to be favored with the draft, on time for us, to really apply our minds to it, because from the legal point of view, there are certain three principal issues that we need, of course, to be comfortable with. One will be that whether to ensure that whether the amendments fit properly to the principal act and in sequence. Two is to ensure that the content of the principal act, whether it should make sure that they are still workable and understandable after the amendments or that they bring in confusion. Three is that we also need to ensure that the amendments usually will normally affect, other laws as well. We need, of course, to be given opportunity, of course, to certify ourselves to show that they don't in conflict with any other laws that must be researched. I think those are the three areas that we're concerned about, but in totality, we are, of course, in principle, concur with most of, with most of the amendments.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, because I think your consent is going to be taken care of. You still have enough time to consider, to look, because in terms of the rules of Parliament, the committee has done a substantive amount of amendments in the Principal Act. So in terms of the rules, it means this bill has to be redrafted, and it's no longer a department bill, it's a parliament bill. However, redrafting the bill means there's still an opportunity for
other processes, consultation processes. So it means we have got an ample time to look. Today, you have a document in your possession. You can start an hour when you leave there. You look at the document. Until such time, we call you back to say, let's deliver it again. I don't think you have been disadvantaged. So on record, just withdraw. Just withdraw your comment. You say you have been disadvantaged. You are not. You still have ample time. Extend the process. Let me explain the process today. As we have met, we are going to consult with the NA, follow the processes of the NA, and then the NA Parliament itself will do what is supposed to be doing. And then it's our figure going in the but in another same Kali Suru kitchen. The kitchen is cool. So, Bana Sobona, well, is that? So, with those few words, I really, really, really wish to. Noliqua, Ufunotin.
My apologies, Chair. I'm not an anti-Gisi process, Chair. I was just concerned about the holy ground of the definitions of composition and membership. And I would like to propose that somewhere in the edge on the definitions, whether whatever word is being used, there it gets a definition because there's a functionality attached to that.
All right. Thank you. So, ngalo mazwi siyanibulela kakhulu ne cooperation yenu. I think we have been working very well with the department. Leo, we must say it repeatedly, even with the state law advisors. I mean, we are cooperating with each other because I believe the issues that are being raised by the members of parliament are not trying to derogate or demean the work that has been done. We appreciate the work of the department. We appreciate the initiatives because we have always been saying, no, as the portfolio committee, let's initiate our own legislation. Let's try and amend. There's pie here. We are saying we are going to amend it, but we are dragging feet. So I think your initiative is very crucial, it's very important to us. So you must not be disappointed. And if we are taking an extra mile, the intention is to enhance and to embrace the work that we have done. So if you are understanding us on those grounds, I don't think there's going to be any problem. But I think I can give the one member from the portfolio committee to just thank you, and then we break for lunch. Lunch? When is lunch? When is lunch? What is it? Okay, you can just take a comfort break, and then we call the next team. Maybe it's not going to take much. We're going to listen to them and respond. That's all. One member, Mrs. Kane, are you going to do what I'm requesting you to do?
Chair, but since you've given me the floor, I just want to go a little bit beyond that. No, I think it's important, Chairperson, that there may be people in this committee that are not aware that this committee has actually done some groundbreaking work here. To my knowledge, there is not a committee in Parliament that have done substantive changes that require the committee to go to the National Assembly and seek permission to do those. And for Kwesi and for the benefit of the media, we are going to open the process of public participation again because of the substantive changes that we have made. And we want to get an early indication from the media that they make the people aware. So whilst we have a public participation, because of the process we've done, because of the substantive changes, we are going to have public participation again, public hearings on this. And it includes, obviously, an opportunity for the department. So I think, Chair, we need to say that because, I don't know, the legal section may be able to assist here, but I don't think any other committee has done this yet with a bill. So it is, in fact, something new in Parliament. Having said that, Chairperson, I think on behalf of the committee, I need to firstly thank certainly the Parliamentary Legal Services. They've done, and we could not have done it without their help.
and a lot of hours was put in at very short notice over weekends, and we need to thank them for that. I also wish, on behalf of you, Chairperson, to thank every member of our committee, the department, state law advisors, and certainly the people out there that have made submissions. And we always have difficulty getting submissions from people. But in their absence, we want to thank those people and hope that they will make further submissions based on the amendments that we've made. And I think lastly, Chairperson, for you as the leader of the committee and who has guided us, you put in an extraordinary amount of work as well. Perhaps I should also thank Member Borman for having done what she did the other night, even though she didn't share it with us. But thank you to everybody. It has been in a very conciliatory fashion, and this committee usually does that, try and work by consensus, and I thank you personally for that, Chair. Thank you.